This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Wild Hunger by Chloe Neal, narrated by Suzanne Elise Freeman. In our youth, our hearts were touched with fire. Oliver Wendell Holmes. Prologue.
No!
A little girl's voice echoed through the hallway. The cry was followed by footsteps, more yelling, and a petulant squeal.
It's mine! You give it back right now, Connor stupid Keen!
The dark-haired boy stuck his tongue out at her. The tiny blonde he relished torturing, then tore down the hallway, holding aloft the plastic sword he'd taken from his enemy.
Victory, he said.
She followed him, Mary Jane's shoes padding down the carpeted hallway, but he was nearly a foot taller, and she knew she couldn't catch him. Not by running. So she called in a reinforcement.
Daddy, Connor Stupid Keen won't give me my sword.
Connor Stupid Keen stopped and spun around, then leveled his best glare at Elisa Sullivan.
I'm a prince, he said, sticking his thumb against his chest. And I can take your sword if I want.
He was 7, and she only 5 and a half, so he was obviously the more mature of the two of them. She jumped up to grab the sword, but couldn't reach it.
Give it back,
You what? He asked with a wily grin, spinning around to keep the toy out of her hands.
What am I? You're a stupid boy, that's what you are.
Children. They froze, then turned back toward the doorway to Elise's father's office, and looked warily at the vampire who filled it.
Is there a problem? He asked.
No, Mr. Sullivan, said Connor, scowling at his companion.
Green-eyed Elisa, just as wily as he was, stuck out her tongue at Connor, then batted her eyelashes at her father.
He took my sword, she said in a small, soft voice she knew was guaranteed to get her way. And he won't give it back.
Son, did you take her sword?
They turned again, saw a tall man at the other end of the hallway.
No, Dad,
Connor said as his father walked toward him. Connor held out the sword and let Elisa take it back, but scowled when she stuck her tongue out at him. Again.
She is so spoiled, he thought.
Gabriel Keen grinned wolfishly, crossed his arms over his chest.
I'm glad we resolved this peacefully.
Ethan Sullivan smiled, one hand braced against the doorframe as he watched his daughter and her nemesis do what they did best.
As am I. Do we need to talk about the house rules again?
No, Daddy.
Elisa tucked the sword behind her back.
Son?
Gabriel asked.
No, Dad.
Connor shifted from foot to foot.
We talked about this.
There was a moment of uncomfortable silence in the hallway.
I know.
As she bit her lip, Elisa looked up at Connor and saw the flush of embarrassment on his cheeks. She didn't like being teased, or not that much anyway, but she really didn't like that look on his face. She stepped forward, putting her small body between Connor and his father.
It was my fault, she said.
Arching an eyebrow, Gabriel crouched down, hands clasped in front of him.
Was it now?
Worriedly, she looked back at Connor, then at his dad, and nodded once. Gabriel leaned in and whispered quietly.
Is it your fault, or do you just not want Connor to get in trouble?
In the just slightly too loud whisper of a child, she said,
I don't want Connor to get in trouble.
Ah.
He nodded gravely, then stood again. Connor moving to stand beside him.
I think we've gotten things cleared up then, he said,
then ruffled his son's hair. Connor grinned at him, leaned against his father, and stuck his tongue out at Elisa. 1. Vampires were made, not born. All except one. All except me. I was the daughter of vampires, born because magic and fate twisted together. I'd spent 19 years in Chicago. Tonight, I stood nearly 400 feet above Paris, several thousand miles away from the Windy City and the houses in which most of its vampires lived. Around me, visitors on the second level of the Eiffel Tower sipped champagne and snapped shots of the city. I closed my eyes against the warm, balmy breeze that carried the faint scent of flowers. Elisa, you cannot tell Paris goodbye with your eyes closed. I'm not saying goodbye, I said, because I'm coming back. I opened my eyes, smiled at the vampire who appeared at my side with two plastic cones of champagne. Seraphine had golden skin and dark hair, and her hazel eyes shone with amusement. To Paris, I said, and tapped my cone against hers. It had been 4 years since I'd last stepped foot in Chicago. Tomorrow, I'd go home again and visit the city and spend time with family and friends. For 20 years, there'd been peace in Chicago among humans and subs, largely because of efforts by my parents, Ethan Sullivan and Merritt, the master and sentinel, respectively, of Cadogan House. They'd worked to find a lasting peace, and had been so successful that Chicago had become a model for other communities around the world. That's why Sari and I were going back. The city's four vampire houses were hosting peace talks for vampires from Western Europe, where houses had been warring since the governing council, the Greenwich Presidium, dissolved before I was born. And vampires' relations with other supernaturals in Europe weren't any better. Chicago would serve as neutral territory where the house's issues could be discussed and a new system of government could be hammered out.
You look, what is the word, wistful?
Sari smiled. And we haven't even left yet. I'm building up my immunity, I said, and sipped the champagne.
You love Chicago.
It's a great city, but I was a different person in Chicago. I like who I am here. Paris wasn't always peaceful, but it had given me the time and distance to develop the control I'd needed over the monster that lived inside me. Because I wasn't just a vampire. Sari bumped her shoulder against mine supportively.
You will be the same person there as you are here. Miles change only location. They do not change a person's heart, a person's character.
I hoped that was true, but Sari didn't know the whole of it. She didn't know about the half-formed power that lurked beneath my skin, reveled in its anger. She didn't know about the magic that had grown stronger as I'd grown older, until it beat like a second heartbeat inside me. Sunlight and aspen could kill me, but the monster could bury me in its rage. I spent the past 4 years attending École Dumas, Europe's only university for supernaturals. I was one of a handful of vampires in residence. Most humans weren't changed into vampires until they were older. The change would give them immortality, but they'd be stuck at the age at which they'd been changed. No one wanted to be 13 for eternity. I hadn't been changed at all, but born a vampire. The one and only vampire created that way. Immortal, or so we assumed, but still for the moment aging. The university was affiliated with Paris's Maison Dumas, one of Europe's most prestigious vampire houses, where I'd lived for the past 4 years. I'd had a little culture shock at first, but I'd come to love the house and appreciate its logical approach to problem-solving. If Cadogan was Gryffindor, all bravery and guts, Dumas was Ravenclaw, all intellect and cleverness. I liked being clever, and I liked clever people, so we were a good fit. I'd had 4 years of training to develop the three components of vampire strength, physical, psychic, and strategic. I graduated a few months ago with a sociology degree, emphasis in subhuman relations, and now I was repaying my training the same way French vampires did, with a year of mandatory armed service for the house. It was a chance to see what I was made of, and to spend another year in the city I'd come to love. I was 3 months into my service. Escorting delegates from Maison Dumas to Chicago for the peace talks was part of my work.
How many suitcases are you bringing?
I glanced at Sari with amusement. Why? How many are you bringing?
4.
Sari did not travel lightly. We'll only be in Chicago for 4 days.
I have diplomatic responsibilities, Elisa.
I sipped my champagne. That's what French vampires say when they pack too much. I have a capsule wardrobe.
And that is what American vampires say when they do not pack enough. You also have diplomatic responsibilities.
I have responsibilities to the house. That's different.
Ah,
she said, smiling at me over the rim of her drink.
But which one?
Maison Dumas, I said, in an accent that was pretty close to perfect. I'm not going to Chicago on behalf of Cadogan House. It's just a bonus.
I look forward to meeting your parents, and I'm sure they'll be glad to see you.
I'll be glad to see them, too. It's just, I've changed a lot in the last few years, since the last time I went home. They'd visited Paris twice since I'd been gone, and we'd had fun walking through the city, seeing the sights. But I still felt like I'd been holding myself back from them. Maybe I always had. It's not about you or Cadogan or Chicago, I'd told my father, when we'd stood outside the private terminal at O'Hare, in front of the jet that would take me across the world. I'd been struggling to make him understand. It's about figuring out who I am. In Chicago, I was the child of Ethan and Merritt, and it had been hard to feel like anything more than a reflection of my parents and my birth, which made me a curiosity for plenty of sups outside Cadogan House who treated me like a prize. And the possibility I might be able to bear children made me, at least for some, a prize to be captured. I'd wanted to be something more, something different, something that was just me.
You couldn't fail us by living your life the way you want, my father had said. It's your life to live, and you will make your own choices. You always have.
He tipped my chin up with the crook of his finger, forcing me to meet his gaze.
There are some decisions that we make, and some that are made for us. Sometimes you accept the path that's offered to you, and you live that path, that life, with grace. And sometimes you push forward, and you chart your own path. That decision is yours. It's always been yours. I don't want you to go because I'm selfish, because you are my child.
His eyes had burned fiercely, emeralds on fire.
But if this is your path, you must take it. Whatever happens out there, you always have a home here.
He'd kissed my forehead, then embraced me hard.
Test your wings, he'd quietly said. A suggestion, a request, a hope. And fly.
I had flown, and I'd read and walked and learned and trained, just like everyone else. In Paris, I'd been just another vampire, and the anonymity, the freedom, had been exhilarating.
We all carry expectations, Sari said quietly, her eyes suddenly clouded. Sometimes our own, sometimes others. Both can be heavy.
Sari came from what the European houses called good blood. She'd been made by a master vampire with power, with money, with an old name, and with plenty of cachet. And that mattered to French vampires. Sari had been the last vampire he'd made before his death, and those of his name were expected to be aristocrats and socialites. Unlike in the U.S., French vampires selected their own houses. She'd picked Maison Dumas instead of Maison Bourdillon, the house of her master. That hadn't made her many friends among Bourdillon's progeny, who decided she was wasting her legacy.
Are you excited to see Chicago? I asked her.
I am excited to see the city, she said, if not optimistic about what will come of the talks. Consider Calais.
The most recent attack had taken place in Calais a week ago. Vampires from Paris's Maison Solignac had attacked Maison Saint-Germain because they believed they weren't getting a big enough cut of the city port's profits. In the process, 4 vampires and 2 humans had been killed. The European houses had lived together peacefully, at least by human standards, for hundreds of years. But after the GP's dissolution, all bets were off. There was power to be had, and vampires found that irresistible. More than 12 delegates from France, including Sari and Marion, the master of Maison Dumas, would participate in the talks. Marion and Sari would be accompanied by nearly 12 staff, including Marion's bodyguard, Sari's assistant Odette, and me.
Yeah, I said. I don't know how successful it will be either. But refusing to talk certainly isn't doing much good.
Sari nodded and drank the last of her champagne as 2 guards passed us, 1 human, 1 vampire, and silenced the chatter. They wore black fatigues and berets and looked suspiciously at everyone they passed. Part of the joint task force created by the Paris Police Prefecture to keep the city safe. The vampire's eyes shifted to me, then Sari. He acknowledged us, scanned the rest of the crowd, and kept walking, katana belted at his waist. Vampires in the U.S. and Western Europe used the long and slightly curved Japanese swords, which were sharp and deadly as fangs, but with a much longer reach. Sorcerers had magic, shifters had their animal forms, vampires had katanas.
Verchavi, Seraphine whispered, and watched as they kept moving, then disappeared around the corner.
Javi was a Dumas vampire doing his year of service. They weren't the only guards at the Eiffel Tower. Humans and vampires alike stood at the edge of the crowd below, wearing body armor and weapons, and trying to keep safe the tourists and residents enjoying a warm night in the Champ de Mars. We turned back to the rail, looked over the city. So much white stone, so many slate roofs. So many people enjoying the warm night. But the specter of violence, of fear, hung over it. And that was hard to shake. No city was perfect, not when people lived in it.
Let us take a photo, Sari said, clearly trying to lift the mood.
She put an arm around me, then pulled out her screen and angled the narrow strip of glass and silicone for a perfect shot.
To Paris, she said, and we smiled.
The moment recorded, she checked the time before putting the device away again.
We should get back. The auto will arrive in a few hours.
She slipped an arm through mine.
This will be an adventure, and we will be optimists. And I look forward to pizza and Chicago dogs and, comment dit-on, milkshake de gâteau?
Cake shake, I said with a smile. You and my mother are going to get along just fine. We'd only just turned to head toward the elevator when screams sliced through the air, followed by a wave of nervous, fearful magic that rolled up from the ground. We looked back and over the rail. Even from this height, they were visible. 5 vampires in gleaming red leather running through the green space with katanas in one hand and small weapons in the other. Not knives. There was no gleam from the flashing lights on the tower. What was shaped like a knife, but held no metal, and would turn a vampire to dust? Humans had been wrong about vampires and crosses, but they'd been absolutely right about stakes. An aspen stake through the heart was a guaranteed way to put the mortal in immortal. I didn't know which house the vampires were from. I was too high to see their faces, and the gleaming red leather didn't give anything away. Leather was a vampire favorite, and French vampire houses appreciated fashion as much as the French fashion houses did. But their intent was clear enough. They ran through the crowd, weapons drawn, and took aim at everyone in their path. Screams, sharp and terrified, filled the air. I watched one person fall, another dive to the ground to avoid the strike, a third try unsuccessfully to fight back against the vampire's increased strength. Paris was under attack. My stomach clenched with nerves and anger. I wanted to help. I was stronger and faster than most humans, and trained as well as any vampire from Maison Dumas would have been. But there were rules. There were roles and responsibilities. The Paris police, the task force members, were supposed to respond to events. I was just a civilian, and only a temporary one at that. I worked for Dumas, and should have been focused on getting Sari safely back to Maison Dumas. But the screams. The guards who'd walked past minutes before ran back to the rail beside us, and stared at the scene below in horror. And neither of them made a move toward the ground. It took only a second to guess why. "Can you jump?" I asked Javi, the vampire. He looked at me, eyes wide. "Quoi?" I had to remember where I was, shook my head, tried again.
"Pouvez-vous sauter?"
"Non." Javi looked down.
"Non, trop haut."
Too high. Most vampires could jump higher and farther than humans, and we could jump down from heights that would easily kill humans. But the trick required training, which I'd learned the hard way, believing I could fly from the Widow's Walk atop Cadogan House. I'd broken my arm, but vampires healed quickly, so that hadn't been much of a deterrent. My mother had taught me the rest. Javi couldn't jump, so he'd have to wait for the elevator or take the hundreds of stairs down to ground level. But I didn't have to wait. I squeezed Sari's hand, told Javi to take care of her, and hoped he'd obey. Before anyone could argue, or I could think better of it, I slid the katana from his scabbard, climbed onto the railing, and walked into space. I descended through rushing darkness. A human might have had a few seconds of freefall before the deadly landing, but for a vampire, it was less a fall than a long and lazy step. Maybe we compressed space, maybe we elongated time. I didn't understand the physics, but I loved the sensation. It was as close to flying as I was likely to get. The first level of the Eiffel Tower was wider than the second, so I had to jump down to the first level, causing more than a few humans to scream, before making it to the soft grass below. I landed in a crouch, katana firmly in hand. My fangs descended, the predator preparing to battle.
While I couldn't see it, I knew my eyes had silvered, as they did when vampires experienced strong emotions. It was a reminder, to humans, to prey, to enemies, that the vampire wasn't human, but something altogether different. Something altogether more dangerous. Two humans were dead a few feet away, their eyes open and staring, blood spilling onto the grass from the lacerations at their necks. The vampires who'd murdered them hadn't even bothered to bite, to drink. This attack wasn't about need. It was about hatred. I was allowed only a moment of shocked horror, of seeing how quickly two lives had been snuffed out, before the scent of blood blossomed in the air again, unfurling like the petals of a crimson poppy. I looked back. A vampire kneeled over a human woman. She was in her early 20s, with pale skin, blonde hair, and terror in her eyes. The vampire was even paler, blood pumping through indigo veins just below the surface. His hair was short and ice blonde, his eyes silver, and the knife he held above the woman's chest was covered with someone else's blood. Anger rose, hot and intense, and I could feel the monster stir inside, awakened by the sheer power of the emotion. But I was still in Paris, and here I was in control. I shoved it back down, refused to let it surface. "Arrêtez!" I yelled out, and to emphasize the order, held my borrowed katana in front of me, the silver blade reflecting the lights from the Eiffel Tower. The vampire growled, lip curled to reveal a pair of needle-sharp fangs, hatred burning in his eyes. I didn't recognize him, and I doubted he recognized me beyond the fact that I was a vampire not from his house, and that made me an enemy. He rose, stepping away from the human as if she were nothing more than a bit of trash he'd left behind. His knuckles around the stake were bone white, tensed and ready. Released from his clutches, the human took one look at my silver eyes and screamed, then began to scramble away from us. She'd survive, if I could lure him away from her. The vampire slapped my katana away with one hand, drove the stake toward me with the other. I might have been young for a vampire, but I was well trained. I moved back, putting us both clear of the human, and kicked. I made contact with his hand, sent the stake spinning through the air. He found his footing and picked up the stake. Undeterred, he moved toward me. This time, he kicked. I blocked it, but the force of the blow sent pain rippling through my arm. He thrust the stake toward me like a fencer with a foil. The movement sent light glimmering against the gold on his right hand. A signet ring, crowned by a star ruby, and the symbol of Maison Saint-Germain. I doubted it was a coincidence Saint-Germain vampires were attacking the ultimate symbol of Paris only a few nights after they'd been attacked by a Paris house. While I understood why they'd want revenge, terrorizing and murdering humans wasn't the way to do it. It wasn't fair to make our issues their problems. I darted back to avoid the stake, then sliced down with the katana when he advanced again. "You should have stayed in Calais," I said in French, and got no response but a gleam in his eyes. He spun to avoid that move, but I managed to nick his arm. Blood scented the air, and my stomach clenched with sudden hunger and need. But ignoring that hunger was one of the first lessons my parents had taught me. There was a time and a place to drink, and this wasn't it. I swept out a leg, which had him hopping backward, then rotated into a kick that sent him to his knees. He grabbed my legs, shifting his weight so we both fell forward onto the grass. The katana rolled from my grasp. My head rapped against the ground, and it took a moment to realize that he'd climbed over me and grabbed the stake. He raised it, his eyes flashing in the brilliantly colored lights that reflected across the grass from the shining monument behind us. I looked at that stake, thought of what it could do and was almost certainly about to do to me, and my mind went absolutely blank. I could see him, hear the blood rushing in my ears, and didn't have the foggiest idea what I was supposed to do, like the adrenaline had forced a hiccup in my brain. Fortunately, beyond fear, and beneath it, was instinct. And I didn't need to think of what would bring a man down. He may have been immortal, and he may have been a vampire. Didn't matter. This move didn't discriminate. I kicked him in the groin. He groaned, hunched over, and fell over on the grass, body curled over his manhood. "Asshole," I muttered, chest heaving as I climbed to my feet and kicked him over, then added a kick to the back of his ribs to encourage him, politely, to stay there. Two guards ran over, looked at me, then him. "Elisa Sullivan," I said, "Maison Dumas." Most vampires who weren't masters used only their first name. I'd gotten an exception since it wasn't practical for a kid to have just one name. They nodded, confiscated the stake, and went about the business of handcuffing the vampire. I picked up the katana, wiped the blade against my pant leg, and dared a look at the field around me. Two of the other Saint-Germain vampires were alive, both on their knees, hands behind their heads. I didn't see the others, and unless they'd run away, which seemed unlikely, they'd probably been taken down by the Paris police or Eiffel Tower guards, fallen into cones of ash due to a deadly encounter with Aspen. Humans swarmed at the periphery of the park, where Paris police worked to set up a barrier. Some of the humans who'd survived the attack were helping the wounded. Others stood with wide eyes, shaking with shock and fear. And more yet had pulled out their screens to capture video of the fight. The entire world was probably watching, whether they wanted to see or not. I found Sari standing at the edge of the park, her eyes silver, her expression fierce and angry. She wasn't a fighter, but she knew injustice when she saw it. I walked toward her, my right hip aching a bit from hitting the ground, and figured I'd passed my first field test. I suddenly wasn't so sad to be leaving Paris. 2. 24 hours later, I woke several thousand feet in the air, senses stirred by the whir of the automatic shutters. The jet's windows had been covered while we slept, protecting us from burning to a crisp in the sunshine. Through the window, orange and white lights glowed like circuits against the long, dark stretch of Lake Michigan, and I could feel the monster inside me reaching out, stretching as if it could touch the familiar energy. The monster had a connection to Chicago, to the city, and the sword that waited in the Cadogan House armory that made it harder to control here. That was one of the reasons I'd gone to Paris, and one of the things I couldn't explain to my father on the tarmac before I left. My heart began to beat faster as the monster's magic rose, and I had to work to slow it down again, to stay in control. I breathed out through pursed lips, concentrating to send it back into darkness again. "I can do this," I told myself. I wasn't the same girl I'd been 4 years ago. I was returning with more strength and experience, and 4 more years of practice in holding it down, keeping it buried, which is where I meant it to stay. I'd be here for only a few days, and then I'd be on my way back to Paris, far from its reach. I would manage it until then, because there was no other choice. Because I wouldn't hurt anyone else, ever again. "Are you all right?" I glanced at Sari, unclenching my fingers from the armrest and giving her what smile I could manage.
Fine, a little groggy.
Her brows lifted, and the expression said she didn't believe me. Sari was a strong psych, and had a sense about people, about emotions, about truth and fiction. And she'd almost certainly felt the magic.
Jet lag, I said, which was mostly true. Vampirism and time zone changes didn't mix well for me even in the best of times. I'd spent most of my first week in Paris napping. She didn't look entirely satisfied, but she nodded.
I'm glad we have only the reception tonight.
She smiled at the attendant, wiped her hands with the hot towel he offered.
I'm not ready to listen to hours of arguing.
Me either.
And I didn't need to be a strong psych to know that no one on the plane was feeling especially optimistic. But they'll have wine or champagne, or both, and we'll only have to go back upstairs when the party's over. The opening reception would be held at the Portman Grand, one of Chicago's poshest hotels, and our home for the next few days. I'd said no to Marion when she offered to let me stay at Cadogan House. There was nothing to be gained from baiting the monster.
You could still change your mind about the hotel, Sari said. Stay at Cadogan so you can see your parents more often.
I made myself smile at her. I'll be working. Diplomatic responsibilities, remember? And a little more peace. We landed safely, and half the passengers applauded the pilot, which I always found weird. The flight crew had done exactly what they'd been hired to do, get us safely across the ocean. Would we have heckled the pilot if the plane had gone down? I unbuckled my seatbelt and stood, then picked up my bag and katana. The scabbard was the marbled green of malachite, the handle corded with silk of the same color. The blade was pristine, the edge so thin and sharp that even Muramasa himself, one of the masters of Japanese sword making, would have approved. It had been a gift from my mother for my 18th birthday, the first sharpened sword I'd been allowed to wield. And I had learned to wield it, to unsheath it, to defend with it, to attack with it. I was well-trained, and I'd been in skirmishes before, but I'd never killed with it. I hadn't seen violent death at all until the Eiffel Tower incident. Before then, I hadn't seen empty and staring eyes, the visible proof of how quickly and ruthlessly life could be stolen. And I had a very bad feeling those memories wouldn't fade as quickly. The vampire seated in front of us rose and stretched, startling me from the memory. He glanced around the plane, smiled in our direction. He was tall and lean, with taut, pale skin. His hair was silvery gray, his eyes pale blue and deep set, topped by darker brows.
Ladies, he said in accented English, did you enjoy your flight? It is better than flying across the Atlantic on the wings of the bat, no?
His smile was halfway between smarmy and silly. His name was Victor, and he was one of the high-ranking vampires from Maison Chevalier, another house in Paris. Unlike Marion, who liked to think and consider, Victor was a politician all the way through. Strategic, as all vampires were, and skilled at getting his way. But he was honest about it, and seemed to be always smiling, so it was hard not to like him. Our arms would be so tired, I said with as much smile as I could muster. He grinned, pointed at me.
Exactement.
He pulled from his suit jacket a small box and flipped up the lid. A half dozen tiny and violently crimson macarons sat inside.
Would you care for a bite before we disembark?
Sari shook her head.
No, merci.
Blood-flavored macarons were all the rage among French vampires. I could deal with the flavor. I was a vampire, after all. But I didn't like macarons even in the best of times. They were too indecisive. Were they candies? Cookies? I had no idea, and I didn't like snacks that couldn't commit.
No, thank you, I said with a smile.
You may proceed, the flight attendant said, allowing us to move toward the door.
Have a wonderful evening.
Victor gave a little salute.
Ladies, au revoir. I will see you at the party.
Au revoir,
Sari said, and lifted a hand to him.
You really shouldn't encourage him,
she murmured when Victor disappeared ahead of us. He's charming in his way, I said, following her into the aisle.
You should not have laughed at the bat joke. He would believe he is a great comedian, and we will never be done with his attempts at humor. I don't know if I can stand an immortality of it.
We will persist, I said gravely, but his offer had me thinking and worrying. I didn't bring any souvenirs for my parents. Maybe I should have bought macarons at the airport.
It is a rule, Sari said, that one should not buy gifts at an airport.
Okay, but which is more important, buying gifts for your family at an airport or showing up without gifts at all? She pursed her lips as she considered.
You should have bought macarons at the airport, but Chicago will be glad to have you home, macarons or not. You are the prodigal daughter returning.
I guess we'll see about that, I murmured, descended the steps, and breathed in the humid air of a Midwestern August.
I didn't recognize the cluster of humans who waited on the tarmac at the bottom of the stairs, but they introduced themselves as members of the mayor's staff. With apologetic and politic smiles, they explained delegates were arriving from all over the world, so the mayor simply couldn't greet every sup personally. Given she was human, I didn't expect her to literally be in more than one place at a time. A line of vehicles waited to take passengers and luggage to their respective hotels. Most were boxy and gleaming autos that didn't need drivers, and would have been pre-programmed to send us to our destination. In front of them stood my parents. My father, Ethan Sullivan, was tall and pale, with golden blonde hair down to his shoulders that matched my own. As on most nights, he wore a black suit and a cool expression. That was the result of 400 years of playing vamp politics and having to learn early on to ignore the details to focus on the primary goal, the survival of his house and the vamps who lived there. My mother, Carolyn Merritt, just Merritt to most, stood beside him in slim-fitting black pants and a simple pale blue top, her hair dark and straight, her face framed by bangs. Her eyes were pale blue, her nose straight, her mouth wide, and she was pretty in an elegant way. My dad called her Duchess, which fit until you heard her curse like a sailor or do battle against nachos. There was nothing aristocratic about that or her fighting skills. Give a trained dancer a katana, and she'll show you something spectacular. She now stood sentinel for the house, a guardian for the organization and its master. My mother was over 50, and my father more than 400. Neither had aged since I'd been born. They looked barely older than me. Humans usually found that weird, but to me, it just was. They were my parents. And they looked the way they looked. Wasn't it weirder to have parents who looked a little different with each month and year that passed? I'd eventually stop aging too, or so we assumed. As the only vampire child ever born, we were writing the book about the growth of vampire children. For now, at least, I figured I looked exactly my 23 years. Bag and katana in hand, I made my way down the stairs. And the second I stepped foot onto asphalt, onto Chicago, the monster reached for the ground, for the city and its magic, and the power of its desire nearly buckled my knees. My parents didn't know about the monster. They knew only that I'd once lost control, and a human had paid the price. I had a momentary flash of panic that I'd be overwhelmed by it, that they'd see that the monster was still inside me, caged but alive. Had probably been there since I'd been born, since I'd been magically fused to my mother. Because evil had been magically fused to me, or at least that's what I thought had happened. Knowing would break their hearts, and I couldn't bear both the monster and weight of their grief. So I reached for every ounce of strength I had, forced myself to take one more step, then another. 4 years of intense training, and cold sweat still trickled down my spine as I walked toward my parents. But they didn't seem to see it. "It's so good to see you," my mother said, wrapping her arms around me the moment I put down my bag and placed the scabbard on top. She smelled the same, her perfume clean and crisp and floral. The scent made me think of our apartments in Cadogan House, where the pale and pretty fragrance had permeated the air. "We missed you so much," she said quietly, her arms a ferocious band that seemed to quiet the monster. Maybe the monster was afraid of her. If my theory was right, it had reason to be. "I missed you guys too," I said.
"You look happy," my father said, giving me a hug and pressing a kiss to the top of my head.
When he released me, my mother held out a steaming to-go cup. "I thought you could use this after your flight."
"Thank you," I said, and took a sip. It was hot and sweet, with just a hint of hazelnut. I'd have sworn the grogginess started to fade immediately, but that might have been my obsession talking.
"This is perfect," I said. "Leo's?"
"It is," she said with a smile.
Leo's was my favorite coffee spot, a tiny box of a drive-thru in Hyde Park not far from Cadogan House. The menu was limited, the servers were always surly, and it took only cash. But if you could get past the irritations, it was the best coffee in the city.
"If you're going to do something," she said, in a pretty good imitation of my father's voice, "do it right."
"You're hilarious, Sentinel."
"I know. I love your hair," she said, touching a long curl of it.
"Thanks."
It had taken a while to figure out what to do with the blonde waves I'd inherited from my father's side of the family. Too short, and it was a puffball of curls I couldn't pull off. Longer, the curls relaxed and became waves that were much more flattering.
"How was your flight?" my father asked.
"I was asleep for most of it." I held up my hand. "No burns, so the shutters worked. Private jet from Europe was nice. Free headphones and socks." My mother's eyes lit.
"Was there a snack basket?" "You have an entire kitchen at your disposal," my father said.
"And Margot's too busy to walk around and offer me snacks all night." Her gaze narrowed. "Although that gives me some ideas."
"As you can tell," my father said with amusement, "your mother has not changed a whit since we saw you in May."
"I'm good with that," I said.
"We saw the footage from Paris," my father said, and put a hand on my mother's shoulder.
I'd prepared them, told them we'd been involved, so he wouldn't learn about the fight secondhand. But the fear and grief in his eyes was still keen. Tears welled in my eyes, too. Suddenly swamped with the horror I'd seen the night before, I pushed the cup of coffee at my father and flung myself into my mother's arms.
All right, she said, embracing me again. It's all right. Get it out of your system. You'll feel better.
It was horrible.
I mumbled it into her shirt.
It was stupid, and it was senseless, and it was so violent.
It always is horrible, she whispered, rubbing my back. It's not an advantage to be numb to terrible things. It means we can't feel. When we can feel, we do it anyway. We show our bravery. In terrible times are when we need to act most of all. That's when we do the most good.
She held me while I stood there, crying onto her shirt, until I'd wrung out the worst of the emotion. Then I pulled back and wiped my cheeks.
Sorry, I said, trying for a half laugh. I'm not sure why I'm crying. That was not very professional.
My father pulled an embroidered handkerchief from his pocket. I took it, swiped at my face. I felt childish for needing to cry, but a little better for having done it.
You've had a long 24 hours, my mother said. And you care about people. And you care about Paris. That's as professional as it gets.
She's right, my father said, earning a thumbs up from my mother.
You handled yourself well. We were very proud.
The tightness in his eyes said he was working hard not to replay the discussion we'd already had about the risks of my Dumas service. He knew this was my story to write.
Thanks, I said, and gave my face a final wipe, then stuffed the handkerchief into my pocket.
Now, my mother said, looking around, when do we get to meet Seraphine? She hadn't been in town when they'd come to my graduation. I glanced back at the jet, found Sari chatting with Odette at the bottom of the jetway, and waved her over.
Bonjour,
she said brightly when she reached us, slipping an arm through mine. Sari, these are my parents, Ethan and Merritt.
It is lovely to finally meet you,
Sari said, and exchanged kisses with them.
Your daughter is a jewel.
We agree, my father said. And we hope you enjoy Chicago as much as she's enjoyed Paris.
I'm sure I will.
She looked at my mother.
I understand we should discuss, cake shakes?
My mother's face lit up like she'd won the lottery.
We should discuss them. Maybe we'll make good progress at the talks tomorrow, and we'll have time for a Portillo's adventure.
Let us hope, Sari said with a smile, which quickly faded.
You have heard about the recent attack?
We did, my father said.
Have there been any threats against the talks? I asked. My father lifted an eyebrow. I'm in service to Maison Dumas, I reminded them. I'm working.
No threats, my mother said, taking my father's hand and squeezing, probably giving him a signal.
They could also communicate telepathically, one of the common vampire skills I hadn't developed, probably because I hadn't been made in the traditional way of vampires. So it wasn't often I'd heard them disagree aloud about how to handle me or something I'd done. Because of that, I'd had zero luck playing the "Mom said it was okay" card. Mom and Dad could check with each other without my even knowing it.
Although the Spanish delegates are still arguing about seating positions, my father said, clearly not impressed with the behavior.
You've seen the security plan for the Sanford? My mother asked. The talks would be held at the remodeled Sanford Theater, and while Chicago might have been peaceful, the event's organizers weren't taking any chances. There'd be barriers outside the building, guards inside and outside the facility, and security forces in the room in case anyone got brave. The forces would be a mix of human and supernatural, primarily vampires and members of the North American Central Pack of Shifters, as the pack had made its home in Chicago.
Gabriel Keane was its wolfish apex, no pun intended, and a friend of my parents. Gabriel's son, Connor, and I had grown up together, or mostly. He was 2 years older than me, and figured he was 2 years hipper and wiser. He'd been the bane of my childhood, the irritation of my adolescence. We'd tolerated each other for our parents' sake, or at least as much as two kids could. He thought I was bossy. I liked things the way I liked them. I thought he was reckless. He said he was the prince and could do what he wanted. And, unlike everyone else in my life, Connor Keane had seen the monster.
"If you don't mind," Sari said, "I'm going to join Odette, as she appears frantic."
We looked back at the autos, where Odette was gesturing angrily at the growing pile of luggage.
"I hope they haven't lost your bags," my mother said. "I'm sure it is fine."
She smiled, reached out to squeeze each of my parents' hands in turn.
"It was wonderful to meet you, finally. I hope we will have time to talk."
"We hope so too," my mother said.
"She seems lovely,"
my father said when she'd moved toward the car. "She is. She doesn't take what she has for granted, which would be very easy for her to do."
"Then she's in good company," my father said with a smile. "Not many would agree to a year of service when it wasn't owed."
"It was owed in spirit, even if not technically," I said.
"You are your mother's daughter," my father said, with not a little pride in it. "As if the 38 hours of labor didn't prove it," my mother said with a smile.
"I recall them well," my father said flatly. "You were very angry."
"Was it the cursing that tipped you off?"
"And the throwing of many objects," he said,
counting them off on his hands.
"And challenging an apex shifter to a knife fight, and accusing your sister of being a Russian spy, and promising to stake the doctor if you didn't get drugs."
"Nonsense. I was a paragon of patience and gentility." My father winked at her.
"Of course you were, Duchess. And to my point, you were also a very careful sentinel."
"Why are you smiling?" my mother asked me, eyes narrowed. "Just, it's good to be home," I told her, "and I hoped it would stay that way." "Good," my mother said, "because we're glad you're here too." She tapped a silver band on her right ring finger, checked the time. "You should probably get to the hotel. Someone from the ombudsman's office will meet you there, give you your badges, and make sure you get into the reception." Relations between Chicago's humans and vampires were managed by the city's supernatural ombudsman. My great-grandfather, Chuck Merritt, had been the first ombudsman, and the office had grown since his retirement 10 years ago. William Dearborn held the office now.
"Sounds good."
I glanced over at the slate-gray McLaren coupe parked between the autos, and guessed it was my father's newest vehicular obsession. He didn't care to be driven, and much preferred to drive. "Yours?" I asked him, gesturing to it. My mother pulled a key fob from her pocket, smiled. "Mine. He's destroyed too many vehicles."
"In fairness, you were with me for most of those incidents."
"That's why I'm driving," she said, and pressed a kiss to my cheek. "The auto will take you to the hotel. We'll see you at the reception." I nodded. "See you there." Odette met us at the auto and offered small bottles of water. Like Sari, Odette had been made a vampire by a powerful and respected master.
"Your parents are very much in love," Sari said when we slid into the vehicle together.
"Yeah, they are." I looked as my dad reached out, took my mother's hand.
They walked together toward her car. "It's pretty disgusting," I said with a smile.